nanohub.org. You can follow along with this presentation using printed slides from the NanoHub. Visit www.nanohub.org and download the PDF file containing the slides for this presentation. Enjoy the show.
So for the test, we'll post the solutions today. So you can look at it, and if you have questions and you want to discuss with me, please send me email. And generally, I'd say, you know, I thought people did quite well. If you're thinking in terms of grades, I'd say, you know, if you got, say, about above 25 or so, that means you are in, you're quite solid. I'd say between 20 and 25, that's more like a B. Less than 20, you should probably see me or talk with. We should discuss what if there's a problem, right? That's just to give you a rough idea. But generally, I'd say, you know, people did quite well. The average was about 25 or so. And this only question on which there was some confusion. So let me just say a couple of words about it. And that was problem 3, which had to do with this thing about how to write down the solution to a differential equation. And in this class in general, of course, I've not been stressing differential equations very much, because what we do is we talk more about matrices. And as I said, you can turn differential equations into matrix equations. And there are various reasons why I kind of stick to that. At some point, I'll try to explain the relative advantages and disadvantages of doing it one way or the other. But in the context of differential equations, though, thing is, most of the literature usually is based on differential equations. You know, Schrodinger equation, to start with, is a differential equation. And one of the few things I expect you to know about it is that if you have a differential equation that looks like, you know, the Schrodinger equation, let's say, looks something like this. I'm just doing this in two dimensions. So if I look at this, I'd say this is a differential equation with constant coefficients. Constant coefficients in the sense that what appears here does not vary with x or y. So you're talking about a homogeneous medium. That's what homogeneous means. In space, it does not vary. Okay? Time invariant means it doesn't vary in time. So this is an example of a homogeneous medium. This isn't varying with x. And any such differential equation, I guess I should have a psi there, you can write the solution in this form. So this is a solution that will satisfy this differential equation, provided you choose these two numbers. Remember, kx and ky are numbers. They're not supposed to be functions of x and y. They're just numbers, whatever it is. As long as those numbers are chosen correctly, you know, for a given E, you'd want a particular choice. And how do I know this? Well, this is the point I made, that with differential equations, there is really no logical way to write down a solution. It's more like, over the years, people have developed an entire catalog of solutions. That if you have a differential equation like this, some solutions like this will satisfy it. And if you take a course in differential equations, you learn many of them. Okay? And in this class, of course, you know, people have very different backgrounds. Some who know a lot about differential equations have been exposed to it in other courses. People who haven't. Okay? But in this context, the point I always make is, even if you have never heard about this, like, where did this come from? If I tell you this, then as long as you know how to take derivatives, in the next 10 minutes, you should be able to tell me whether I'm right or wrong. Because you can always plug it in and see if it works. Okay? Okay. So now, if I had a term here, an additional term here, that looks like some function of x, let's say, times psi, then you can plug this in and you can see that this won't work necessarily, if this was, say, a function of x and y, both. Now, if it's a function of x only, then what you can show is this part is okay, but this won't work. You have to find a better function, something else. Did I say this right? No, just the opposite. So what I said is, would apply if that was u of y. So if this is a function of y, then this won't work. You have to find a better function. And what that is will depend on exactly what the nature of that u of y happens to be. You see, and that's where, again, unless you have seen it before, you wouldn't know right away. So, for example, if you take a course in quantum mechanics, one of the problems you would discuss is something called the harmonic oscillator problem, where this one looks like half m omega square y square. I mean, these are constants, and it's proportional to y square. It's a quadratic potential. And that happens to have an analytical solution in terms of what's called the Hermite polynomials, multiplied by a Gaussian function, etc. And that, again, if you have taken a course somewhere, you'd know it. Offhand, it's not like looking at this, you should immediately know that that works. I mean, there's no way you could tell. And these days, of course, with all the internet, if you don't know it, again, if you just type in Hermite polynomials or something, you can into Google, you'll find a page that explains it, lists all the functions, and you can find it in no time, what you need. Right? And the main point I want to get across here is, looking at a differential equation, it's not easy to write down a solution. But if someone tells you a solution, you should be able to tell if he's right or wrong, number one. And number two, the thing that you should remember, elementary point, is if you have a differential equation with constant coefficients, exponentials will work. And that applies to each variable, x, y, z, and time. So, for example, this part is actually supposed to be ih bar d psi dt. But as long as I'm dealing with time-invariant problems, nothing changes with time, I am allowed to write the solutions like this and then carry on with this equation, carry on with the time-independent version. Right? So, yeah, this is the only problem where there seemed to be considerable confusion. So I thought I'd say a few words about it. And in general, you know, I think most people didn't have much trouble with the test. So I'll just post the solutions, and if you want to discuss anything, let me know. Okay. Now, to get back to what we were discussing then, and that's about how to include spin into our thinking. And as I'd mentioned, that in our general model, all that really spin does is that it makes every matrix 2 times as big. In other words, if you had a device that you are representing with, say, 1 point, now you would actually have 2 components. And so it's like 2 channels. And there are lots of phenomena involving spin that you could understand simply by saying, well, you know, you just have 2 lanes, you know, an up spin lane and a down spin lane, and keep track of that, and you can handle that. And that's why most of the time you're usually just multiplying by 2 at the end. And last day I discussed an effect, a very important effect, this magnetoresistance, giant magnetoresistance, which actually arises from the fact that you have 2 lanes, but then they do not couple equally to your contacts. One of them is a little easier to get in and out. Why? Because you have used magnets for your contacts. And magnets have that property that they allow one spin to get out more easily than the other one. Now, as I said last day, what requires a little deeper understanding of all this is if you ask questions like, well, what would happen if you had one magnet this way and the other magnet was, say, at 90 degrees? Not anti-parallel, but just kind of halfway. How do you think about that, for example? And this is where I mentioned that it's a lot like the nearest analogy I know is the polarization of light. And polarization of light, as you know, if you have a polarizer like this and an analyzer here, then light, let's say, comes in with some polarization. And if the analyzer is parallel to the polarizer, it will let it go right through. But if I turn the analyzer, then I can block some of it. How much do I block? Well, the fraction that will get through is cosine squared theta. So as I turn it by an angle theta, once it's 90 degrees, it's completely blocked. So what gets through is cosine squared theta. And the spin of an electron is a lot like polarization, except for this very important difference. Right? And that is that, you know, if you think of the magnets, the two magnetic contacts as a polarizer and analyzer, the point is that what gets through is cosine square half theta, not theta. And so, in order to block it, you actually have to go 180 degrees. So, it's like up and down, like, you know, parallel and anti-parallel. You actually have to turn this around. So, that's the very important difference here, which, as I said, mathematically, you could, all the mathematical consequences you could work out if you accept one thing, and that is, if we accept that just as with vectors, we write the components of a vector, the x component, the y component, and the z component. So, y, z components, we write as z is cosine theta, this is sine theta cosine phi, and this is sine theta sine phi. This is how you'd write down the components of a vector. That's something you learn in your freshman year or even earlier, right? Somewhere out there. Whereas with spinors, the way you're supposed to write them is up and a down component. The up component is cosine half theta, exponential minus I half phi. And this is sine half theta, exponential plus I half phi. So, a vector has three real components. So, if we are trying to represent an object with, say, unit magnitude, so it's, I mean, this magnitude is one, but it can point in various directions. And the which direction it points, that's denoted by these two angles, theta and phi. And as you know, the way you usually define this theta and phi, let's say this is the z direction, that's the x direction, and theta is this angle between the z, the angle it makes with the z axis. And phi is the angle that if you project it on the xy plane, then what angle it makes with the x axis. Now on this, by the way, there's sometimes some confusion because some books reverse this theta and phi. That is, they call this one phi and call the other one theta. Okay? But I'll try to be consistent and use this. Okay? So, theta is the angle with the z-axis and phi is the angle in the xy plane. Okay. So, we have this thing of unit amplitude that points in some direction and we are trying to write its components. And one way to write its components is, think of it as a vector, three real things. And spinor is another way of writing it, where, in a way, you got two components, but now they're complex. Okay. Now, as I said, if you accept this, then all the other consequences will follow. But this is, of course, not obvious. In other words, how did we come up with this? Could we have just written anything here? Of course not. Anything else wouldn't have given you a consistent theory. Right? There's only a few things that will give you a consistent theory. And how do you know which ones are consistent? That I'm not discussing yet. Hopefully, we'll get to it by the end of the class. Right? Why does this work? And just as this works. Right? Okay. But let's accept this, and then what I claim is, rest of it kind of follows. Right? And one example I mentioned last day is, in that case, how do I handle something who's in a magnet that points this way? Well, we said that if you took up and down along this direction as your basis, then the sigma would have looked like alpha, beta, 0, 0. If you took that particular direction up, you know, this way and that way as your basis. But then you can always transform it to whatever basis you want. Right? That was the point I had made earlier, and we'll be using this a lot more as we go along. Okay. Now, what we want to do is talk about a problem like this, where, let's say, from here, a spin is injected, and let's say we have perfect contact, so what comes in is an upspin. And if this magnet is also in the same direction, you'd think you should get a lot of current because its upspin comes in and can get right out.
Good.
But if you put a magnetic field here that's perpendicular to this, let's say in this direction, for example, or in this direction, what happens is that the spin actually wants to rotate around that magnetic field. Now, that's not meant to be obvious. I'll try to explain why. And as I said, all consequences will come out automatically as long as you accept this. Okay? So if I put a magnetic field in a direction, say Z direction, the thing is the spin will want to rotate about that. Now, because it rotates, what will happen is by the time it gets here, although the magnet's the same way, the spin has changed directions. And so now it can't get out very well. And if it has changed directions by, has become completely anti-parallel, then it will be blocked. So what you'd expect then is that if you plot the current, you'd see something like putting a magnetic field. When it's zero, let's say you get a lot of current out, but gradually it will come down. And it will oscillate as you turn up the magnetic field because depending on what the strength of the magnetic field is, it will rotate by different amounts. Or if you had a fixed magnetic field and you just change the length, then also it would rotate. But of course, experimentally, it's easier to be changing the magnetic field with a fixed length. And in practice, what happens though is this oscillation doesn't go on forever. It actually decays. After some time, there isn't any oscillation anymore after some value of magnetic field. It gradually dies out, and this is viewed as a measure of the spin dephasing time, that how far spin information is actually propagated, and that's called the Hanley effect, actually. So, and this has been observed in devices, I mean in solid-state devices. It's, I think based in devices in silicon, people have seen oscillations, you know, like 10-20 of these, 10-20 oscillations. Whereas there are many experiments where you see just one or two oscillations. And this, as I mentioned, is a lot more subtle effect that requires a much deeper understanding of spin. See?
One thing I just want to know, why is it that when both the contacts are in parallel, does the, for example, both of them are in up direction, why does the current want to go out and if it is, if we are injecting off spins, and why doesn't it, what is the physical reason behind it?
Okay, now.
Is it due to Pauli's exclusion principle?
No, that's a totally separate issue. Because I'd say that it is, I mean, basically it's like light, again, polarization, polarizer and analyzer. So I would say if you had a polarizer here and an analyzer that was parallel, then the light would go right through. If I turned the analyzer, I'd be able to block part of it. Right? There'll be a cosine squared theta that would get through. And the only difference is, in this case, it will not be cosine squared theta, but it will be cosine squared half theta.
So it has nothing to do with
exclusion principle, because light doesn't have one anyway. So I'm saying that's a whole separate issue, not important here, right? So, and when you analyze a real device, some of the extra complications could be that the part of the light that got turned around could come back, get turned around again, and then go there. So there could be multiple reflections, etc. So those are issues that could come in when you're actually analyzing a real device with all the things in it. But roughly speaking, the point is what comes in, it tries to get out, and what fraction gets out? Well, just like a polarizer and an analyzer, but instead of cosine squared theta, it's cosine squared half theta. And the fact that spin is different from just polarization, I'd say, based on this experiment, you could say that this is a direct proof of that or evidence of that. The fact that you have to turn the magnet not by 90 degrees but by 180 degrees, that immediately tells you you need something more than vectors to understand this, I'd argue. Okay. Now, the question is then, when I put a magnetic field, how do I include it in this, into this Hamiltonian here? Okay? Because we have sigma 1, sigma 2, that just tells you how spins come in and all that. But the magnetic field acts to this Hamiltonian. And because of that magnetic field, then the spin rotates. So first thing I need to know is how to put it into the Hamiltonian. And the way it enters the Hamiltonian is something like this, that if I put a magnetic field in the z direction, then the way it would enter is, if you just think of a small device with two spins, so it's a 2x2 Hamiltonian, up and down, that's all. Right? So there's a up and a down, up, down, up in the z direction, down in the z direction, minus z. And the way this will enter is, it will be mu b bz minus mu b bz, 0, 0. So the basic fact is then that up spin, one of these will have its energy increased, one of them will have its energy decreased. That's it. Okay. Now, how do you know this? Well, in terms of spin, the way people first kind of found out about spin, in a way knew that there was something there, is that, is this famous Stern-Gerlach experiment. That is, the way this experiment was done those days was that, you see, what you knew experimentally from classical magnets is that any magnet, you know, a magnet which has a magnetization or a magnetic moment in some direction, any magnet, if you place it in an inhomogeneous magnetic field, then it wants to deflect in the direction of the, in the way the magnetic field is increasing. This is a very well-known fact that's actually used for all kinds of things, you know, to separate magnetic particles. If you put an inhomogeneous magnetic field, they will deflect by different amounts. And that's used for many applications, actually. And what Stern and Gerlach had done, you know, almost 100 years ago, is that they had atoms, actually I believe it was silver atoms, that were going through a magnetic, inhomogeneous magnetic field. And the idea was that if these were magnetic, then they would deflect, and if they were not magnetic, they wouldn't deflect. And what they expected to see was that, well, you know, if they are magnetic, maybe some of them will have a magnetization of so much, someone will have in some other direction, something will have in some other direction. And so on the average, you'd see a big blur here. That is, some atoms would end up here, some atoms would end up there, some atoms would end up there, depending on what their what the component of their magnetization along this direction happens to be. Right? So you'd have a distribution of things. Instead, what the experiment showed was two clear spots, as if this is like a magnet with a very fixed value along plus z and minus z. See? And this was, of course, a complete surprise and not easy to understand in terms of any common sense picture at all. You see? Which is why the picture that emerged was a non-common sense one. I mean, that's the quantum mechanical picture of how we think about these things, with these 2x2 matrices and with components like that we'll talk about. And the thing to remember is that it's not that physics is unreasonable. It's just that the facts themselves are pretty unreasonable. These are the facts, you see? And then what you do is you find the math to fit the facts. That's it. So facts are unreasonable. And that is that when you come in with atoms like this, it is deflected by such an amount that it tells you that each atom is basically then like a magnet with a very fixed value of the magnetization in the z direction. And what is the magnitude of the magnet? Well, that's what's called the Bohr magneton. So from this deflection, they measured exactly what that is. You know, that's the number that goes in there. And that is this Bohr magneton, which is given by Q H bar over 2m. That's the charge on an electron. That's the Planck's constant divided by 2 pi. That's the mass of an electron. Right, over and above Schrodinger equation.
So you have to add the epsilon 0 to this.
Right. So whatever we had before you know, epsilon, epsilon, zero, zero. As I mentioned, without magnetic fields, both spins are equivalent. So whatever we had before, this comes over and above that. Okay? Now, the original experiment was done with silver atoms, but I believe 5 or 6 years later, other people did it with just hydrogen atoms. Because, you know, silver is a complicated atom, and you might say, well, how do you know the magnet is due to the electron? It could be something else. You know, there's so many things in. But they did it with a hydrogen atom, which has only a proton, you know, a positive charge and a negative charge, which means if it's behaving like a magnet, it must be either due to the proton or the neutron. And the proton does have a magnetic moment. It's just that it's a whole lot less than the electron. Because what happens is the proton has a very big mass compared to the electron. So this, the magnetic moment is a whole lot less. So the effect is really believed to be entirely due to the electron. And the thing is, that's the point to note, that you see, there's all these wonderful things called magnets that we are used to. But elementary, all that magnetism really comes from just the electron, because every electron is basically a magnet. And the magnitude of that, of the magnet, the magnetic moment of an electron is this, which if you put in those numbers, actually, you'll get 10 to the minus 23rd, roughly, I think, 9.9 times this probably, ampere square meter. As you know, magnetic moment, the way you think of it often is, it's like a little current loop. That is, if you think of a current going around in a loop like this, then the magnetic moment of that is the current times its area. So this one, you could, for example, visualize as, say, 10 to the minus 3 amperes times 10 to the minus 10th meter square. So it is as if every electron is like a milliamp of, current going around in a little square 1 angstrom. Of course, I could have divided it up any other way also. So no particular fundamental significance to that. I'm just saying that's how you could kind of think of the magnitude. So every electron just basically is like this little magnet. Okay. Now, why aren't all solids magnetic? Well, because normally it's all random, and so it never adds up to much. It's just that there are these special materials called magnets where the because of certain internal forces, and that's again a vast subject in itself, like understanding why some things become magnets. But the thing is, because of these vast internal forces, all the electrons happen to line up. So every electron lines up in exactly the same way. So ordinarily what would have happened is they would have all cancelled each other out. The thing is, it all lines up. And what that means is that when you take a big solid and you have lots of little ones lined up like that, you can see all these internal things cancel. And so the entire solid then acts like a giant solenoid, you know, where basically you have a current running around the surface. And that's exactly what a magnet is like, in the sense that if you take a magnet, say, like in the form of a cylinder, the magnetic field due to that is the same as you'd get if you had a solenoid wrapped right around the surface. That's basically it, you see, like a giant solenoid. And what you can show is that the magnetization of a magnet would be given by this Bohr magneton, or, you know, whatever the magnetic moment is of one of these, times the number of these things that you have per unit volume. Because, as you know, with a solenoid, the way you find the magnetic field is, you take the current going around and multiply it by the number of turns per unit length. So you could write magnetization as equal to current divided by the, you know, the number of turns per unit length. So let us say this side is D. You know, each of these things occupies a cube that's of side D. Then you can see that the number of turns per unit length would be like, you know, you could write I over D. And this is what you could multiply with D squared here and make it D cubed. And that then would be the magnetic moment of one of these. And then 1 over D cubed would tell you how many you have per unit volume. And if you take, I told you earlier that this is about 10 to the minus 23rd ampere square meter. And the number of atoms you have per unit volume, you know, if you think about it, it's about, each one is like 2 or 3 angstrom cubed. That's it. So the amount of volume, so the volume per magnet per atom is, let's say, of the order of 10 to the minus 29th meter cubed or so. That's just based on saying that each one takes up about 2 angstroms, let's say. So this would give you roughly 10 to the 6th amperes per meter. And that's the typical magnetization that you actually see in real-world magnets. But the point I'm trying to make is that basically it all comes from electrons, that every electron is a magnet, and if they all happen to line up, which they normally don't, but in some special materials they do, if they all happen to line up, then that's what leads to magnets. Now, of course, the details will be different. I just assumed 1 Bohr magneton per atom. That's not necessarily true. If it's iron, every atom has about, you know, 4 or 5 magnetic electrons in there, etc. So all those details are different. But roughly, you know, this is the basic idea. Okay. Anyway, so the bottom line then is that if I want to understand or rather include the effect of a magnetic field on these electrons, then what I'd do is put this for plus Z and this for minus Z. And this is the, I guess, this tells you how much the energy is changed for a magnet that is pointing along the Z direction. And this is how much it changes if the magnet is in the opposite direction. That's the idea. Which right now in the Stern-Gerlach, so the idea is that whatever comes in could be in some direction, but they will separate into 2 spots. Right. So what came in, though, in principle, could be in some funny direction. Right. Now this is where, I guess, as I said, the result is an unreasonable one, but. What I'm saying is the experiment that's hard to understand to start with, right? And the quantum picture is that, yes, you have a matrix like this, and what you measure will always be like an eigenvector of that matrix. So one way is that this is one eigenvector, that's the other eigenvector, but that we'll get to shortly. That we'll get to in the next day. Okay. But in this in an experiment like this, though, the way I would say it is that ideally this contact only injects things that are pointing in a particular direction, and then in the presence of a magnetic field it rotates and that changes the current. That would be the simple picture there. Okay. Okay, so the real point I want to get to today is that how do you see that it rotates in this magnetic field? That's what you want to get to. Okay. So I'd say that, well, this part of it, let's assume the epsilon is 0. This discussion, I don't think it matters exactly what the energy level is. So we'll leave that out of the story. So then basically Schrodinger equation would look something like this, IH bar d dt. The up component and the down component is equal to mu b bz minus mu b bz 0, 0, up component and down component. So any spin pointing in any direction, you could think of as having these 2 components, an up component and a down component. And the Schrodinger equation for it would look like this. And usually we work with the time-independent one, but here we are trying to describe how in time it rotates. So we start from this one. Now, this is an equation which is very easy to solve. Why? Because the off-diagonal terms are zero. So it's really just two separate equations. And so you could write the first equation as ih bar du dt is equal to, in the up component, mu b bz times u. So what's the solution to that? So the up component as a function of time will rotate as, will not rotate. What I mean is will change with time as, how do you write the solution? Can you help me? What form will be the function? Exponential, right? So it'll be e to the power mu b bz over ih bar times t. So that's how the phase will rotate with time. That phase will keep changing with time. Okay. Now, similarly, you could write for the down component. Exactly the same thing, except that now, instead of plus mu bz, you have mu b bz, you have the minus. So it'll look something like this. So that's it. So with time, that's how the up component will change and the down component will change. Now the question is, how do I visualize this? You know, remember that up and down is, mentally it's like represents something pointing in some direction. So what exactly is that object doing? And there you see, well, you can compare with what I'd written here before. You know, what I'd had was that up components in general is like cosine theta over 2 minus e to the power minus I phi over 2. And this is cosine theta, sine theta over 2 e to the power plus I phi over 2. So if you compare, you can see that what is happening with time is that theta stays fixed, but the phi keeps changing with time. You see? Remember, an object that is pointing in a direction described by theta and phi has components up and down looking like this. And solving the Schrodinger equation, what we find is the up component will evolve this way, the down component will evolve this way. And what we are now trying to do is look at that algebra and trying to figure out that this thing that we have in our mind that points in a certain direction, how is that changing? And what I argue is that, see, since the prefactor that's fixed, it means this theta should remain the same. And since the phase is changing, it means that phi should be changing with time. So what that means is if this is the z direction, theta is the angle this thing makes with the z direction. So that's fixed. But phi is changing with time. What that means is this thing is rotating like this around the z axis. That's really what it is doing. So the physical picture of this one would be that it's rotating around the z axis. And how fast is it rotating? Well, you could say that phi over 2 is equal to mu b bz over h bar times t. Right? Because the component of this was supposed to be e to the power minus I phi over 2. So this then is what we are associating with I phi over 2 minus. So phi is equal to 2 mu b bz over h bar. So you could write d phi dt is equal to 2 mu b bz over h bar. So let me just write that up here, so you'll have that. Now what you might say is that, well, That's fine, but let's try to, why don't we write a differential equation that tells me how that thing actually, how the x, y, and z components of that thing change with time. You know, that way I don't have to work with this thing I'm not familiar with. I can visualize that vector and its x, y, and z components directly. So couldn't I just try to write an equation for d dt of, say, sx, sy, and sz? You know, where sx, sy, and sz are just the usual components of a vector the way I would have written it. You know, instead of this funny up and down components that I'm not so familiar with. Why don't I write that, you know? And that way I should be able to see how the vector rotates in the first place. Well, we could try to do that because, remember, sx is supposed to be sine theta cosine phi. So what that means is dsx dt is equal to sine theta minus sine theta sine phi d phi dt, which is equal to, see, I'm trying to write dsx dt. Okay, so how much is the sine theta sine phi? Right, remember, sy is sine theta sine phi. Okay. So you could write here minus sy and then the usual, then this 2 mu b bz over h bar. So I'll write that here. It's like proportional to minus sy now. Similarly, if you do dsy dt, you'd get actually a plus something times sx. I'm sorry, sx. And can you tell me what dsz dt would be? Zero. Because, and again, physically you can see that you're rotating around the z-axis, and so the component along z just stays the same. So dsz dt is just plain zero. So if I were to write this in the form of a matrix, you see, I could write something like this. Right, so actually, let me just shift this back a little bit. And what I wrote up here, I could write as 1, 0, write a minus 1 here, and then put mu b b z out here. So what I did just now is, this equation that I had here, I wrote it in the form of a matrix. And you can see dsx dt is equal to minus sy. So that's why dsx dt is 0 times sx minus 1 times sy plus 0. Similarly, dsy dt is proportional to sx, so I have a 1 there, etc. So if I had to write it in the form of a matrix, it would look something like this. So this is the matrix if you're working in terms of these up and down complex spinor components. This is the matrix if you're trying to visualize it as a vector and trying to write how this vector works. Now, What would you do if you had to, let's say, if you wanted to see what would happen if the magnetic field happened to be in the X direction instead of Z direction, or if it happened to be in the Y direction? Well, in terms of the vector, that's pretty easy to write down. Why? Because with the Z direction, you had a minus 1, 1 here between X and Y, and the rest was all zeros. Now, if you were trying to rotate this around X, it would have looked something like this. That's easy enough to write. You know, the matrix you would write here would look something like around X. So it will be 0, 0, 0, 0, probably a minus 1 here, 1, 0, 0. You'd have things like this. That's easy enough to write, because when it's around the z-axis, it's here just by symmetry. You can kind of see if it were around x-axis, it would be somewhere else. And actually, what you can show is that what you have written in the form of a matrix, what it really amounts to is saying that ds dt is equal to 2 mu b b, 2 mu b over h bar b cross s. Now, there's what I have written here in the form of a matrix. You could have written in vector notation just like this. You see, you can show yourself that B cross S is exactly what this is. You see, for example, if you take B cross S and write its X component, it would be BZ times SY, minus BZ SY, etc. So you can convince yourself that that matrix is really just another way of saying this. If you just start from here and try to write down ddt of the three components in terms of a matrix times the three components, you'd get exactly these equations. So sometimes you see when people are dealing with how magnets move in a magnetic field, they use equations like this. Of course, there are additional damping terms they put in, and then they call it the Bloch equation. This is, or various versions of this are used to describe magnets actually, right, when you're trying to think in terms of that. But the point I wanted to make here is that, you see, you can visualize it. Often when you talk about spins, you visualize it as a vector. But then the way it enters Schrodinger equation and components and all that is through as a spinner. That's what you need in order to interface with the Schrodinger equation. The wave function has these two components and all that. And these matrices, these are what are called the rotation matrices. So this is the matrix that rotates you around the z-axis. This is the matrix that rotates you around the y, around the x-axis, I suppose. And similarly here, for spin, this is the matrix that rotates it around the z-axis, sigma z. There's a corresponding one that rotates you around x-axis. That is not so easy to write down, which we'll discuss next day after the, etc. But since we're out of time, let me just say one thing to, so that, just to tie this up, and that is, you know, I mentioned earlier that how is it that you, how do you know that this kind of components will work? You know, this or this. And the point is, this is what I'll talk more about next lecture, is that these matrices have a particular property which is associated with this rotation. That in order to have a consistent theory, the point is, I take something like this and I rotate it into this direction. Or if I go through some other path and rotate it in this direction, point is I should end up with the same final thing. And I need to have a consistent theory for that. And what you learn in when you take a full mathematical course on this, what they show you is the property of this rotation group is that these matrices should obey a certain algebra. Namely, these matrices should have the property that Lx Ly minus Ly Lx is equal to 1. Lz should equal to Lz. So that's the property these rotation matrices should have. And the thing is, if you want to represent these rotatable quantities with two component things, then what you need is a set of 2x2 matrices which have that algebra, which obey that same algebra. And the thing is, these spin matrices, the sigma z, sigma x, etc., those are called the polyspin matrices, it obeys exactly that algebra. Namely, sigma x, sigma y minus sigma y, sigma x is proportional to sigma z. That we'll discuss next day. And And when you take those sigmas and find their eigenvectors, that's when you get these. Just as these would be like the eigenvectors of Lx, Ly, Lz. So that is how you finally come up with this. So this part, of course, you know, we're out of time today, so this is what I'll try to tie up, you know, after the spring break. So have a good break, and we'll see you on Monday.